British Antarctic Survey Archives, Oral History Recording Number 5, James Farrington. A recording of Mr. Farrington, Senior Wireless Operator with Operation Tabarin between 1943 and 1946, in conversation with Miss Joanna Ray, Assistant Archivist of the British Antarctic Survey. Date 1st to the 2nd of December 1986. Location, Mr. Farrington's home at Wantage, Oxfordshire.
Fram, could you give me an outline of your career before joining Operation Tabarin?
Well, Joanna, I don't know if I'd call it a career exactly, but in 1908 I was born and reared in Northern Ireland, and I stayed over there with my family for 13 years, and when the family moved to Yorkshire, I went to Leeds Grammar School. Incidentally, I failed matric. But my main interest in those days was travel and exploration. And I used to attend lectures and read books on travel. And I remember particularly in Leeds attending a lecture by Wilde on Shackleton's endurance expedition, which actually thrilled me. So that you could say my only ambition to visit the distant parts of the world was to, and to find a way to be paid for doing it. Now, in 1929, at the age of 21, I qualified as a marine wireless operator, was accepted by Marconi Company, and joined British Merchant Service. My first ship was a P&O passenger liner to Australia and back. Then I had 2 years foreign service, sailing out of Singapore to many parts in the Far East and islands in the South Pacific as far as New Zealand, on case oil, ship and tanker. In 32 and 34, I had a lot of experience in cargo ships, as well as colliers and coasters plying between Britain and Eastern Europe. And then during that period, I was trying to find a way of either going north by making an application to the Hudson Bay Company in connection with their ship Nascope, or south, in one of Salvatore's whalers or supply tankers, and all these attempts were unsuccessful. Well, in 1935, as I'd failed to reach the colder regions and had no intention of staying at sea for the remainder of my working life, I burnt my boats by resigning from Marconi Company and began a search for a shore job. Now, during that summer, while staying with my father in Swaledale, I learned, by chance, of the discovery investigations and applied for a job in one of the committee ships. After satisfying a selection board in the autumn in London, I was appointed to the Royal Research Ship William Scoresby. My ambition was beginning to be realised. Well, between 1935 and 1938, three commissions in Antarctic waters, whale marking, marine zoology, trawling and recharting. The first commission took us to the southeast of Cape Town, as far as Endemy Land and Kemp Land and McRobertson Coast, as far as longitude 75 east. And on the way back, we actually climbed Scullin Monolith to about 800 feet. I remember I was with Mr. Rayner, who was the scientist, the executive man in charge of that particular commission. And I remember at the very top of the monolith, he turned to me and he said, it would remind you of the cat hole at Kell, wouldn't it, Fram? In actual fact, the cat hole at Kell in the old days was a pub where you used to get a very good lunch for about 2 and 6 months. And it amazed me that Rayner, who was a Yorkshireman, and I, who had spent a lot of time in Yorkshire, were able to make that joke at the top of Skull and Monolith. Well, that was a wonderful trip, because further on, as we came back west, we discovered that the coast was different to what it said on the chart, and we found an extra inlet there that was eventually called
I'll probably come back to you later.
Yes, I'm trying to remember that. Or it's the William Scoresby Inlet. Yes,
oh.
William Scoresby Inlet. And there was quite a bit of changes in the coast there, as I discovered in the polar record later on. Now, the second commission was in fact in the same section of the Antarctic waters, but it wasn't anything like so interesting. I was sorry for the people who were doing one trip, because it was a very bad year for ice, and there was so much of it and bergs that we couldn't get near enough to sight the coast at all. So that was the second trip. But the third trip, which started in 37 and finished in 38, was almost entirely inside the Falkland Islands Dependencies sector. And that, of course, was a marvellous trip. After going south from Montevideo, we called it South Georgia. And there, I remember my first sight of South Georgia. It was a very misty evening, and the operator at the South Georgia coast station was guiding us in as by word of mouth. And I remember that after we'd got in through the narrow entrance to Grytviken, he said, "Well, I can see you now. You're only about 300 or 400 yards from the anchorage. Do you mind if I close down? Because this is the first night of talkie films at Grytviken, and I want to go to them." So I thanked him for that. But I mentioned him because I'll be mentioning him later on. His name was Tim Hooley. Well, from South Georgia, we worked our way down to the South Orkneys, and then back to the South Shetlands, and eventually out as far as Peter the First Island.
Hmm.
Now, that was really most interesting, because the west coast of Graham Land is absolutely superb. And, of course, during it, I made my first connection with a visit to Deception Island, which I was to hear about very much later on.
Yes, I wondered if you had visited it during that time.
Yes. And it was really, really marvellous.
What sort of thing did your duties consist of? Were you solely radio operator, or did you have to muck
in? Oh yes, on the William Scoresby, I was solely the wireless operator.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, in addition to the sending and receiving messages and making rendezvous with the factory ships, from which we had to get our oil, the actual range of the William Scoresby was only about 5,000 miles. And in on each voyage, we did something like 40,000. So it was essential to have somewhere to get our fuel from. And in addition to that, I used to, on the Scoresby, run what was called the Pelagic Newsletter. And that had to be produced each week. But particularly at Christmas time, we had a Christmas number, and we used to go, with the captain's permission, we got the whole, pretty well, the whole crew to take, to write something or do something for it.
A lovely idea. That,
yes.
How was it distributed amongst the factory ships, or was it just...
That was only a one-off on each occasion, and it was only read by the crew of the Scoresby.
Ah.
However, when we got back at the end of that commission, the Discovery Committee office did us the honour of actually having it duplicated, and a copy of a memorial copy, as it were, issued to each of the people who had taken part in the voyage.
Oh, that was really nice. Mm. Good gracious. Mm.
Mind you, I must say that it was only because of the talent amongst the different members of the crew that we made it so good.
Did you actually witness some of the whale marking that the William Scoresby carried out?
Oh, yes.
Could you describe it?
Well, you probably know that the William Scoresby was not much bigger than an ordinary trawler. And instead of a harpoon, she had a forward foredeck and a flying bridge from the proper bridge out onto the foredeck so that they could get there no matter what the weather was like. And they used to fire a stainless steel dart of about 9 inches with a suitable gun from the shoulder after chasing the whales until they got into a position where they could actually hit them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this stainless steel dart penetrated the blubber of the whale. We believe it didn't hurt the whale very much because these blue whales weigh as much as 100 tons
mm-hmm.
and had a lot of blubber on them. The dart was marked with a number and and a note to the effect that if found it should be returned to the Natural History Museum in London.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew where it was marked, where the whale was marked, and of course the factory ship gave the information as to where the dart had been found. And that was the way, rather like marking birds, you know, that was the way that the Discovery Committee scientists got to know about the movement of whales.
Mm. In fact, we have the records of the whale marking by the William Scoresby at British Antarctic Survey now. It's of the Sea Mammal Research Unit archive.
So
it links it up very nicely.
Yes, it does.
Mm.
Yes, I must tell you sometime again about the marking, because there was a poem written about it in Pelagic News.
Yes, I've never seen a copy of that, actually.
Yes.
I expect they're few and far between, that's why.
Yes. Well, now, that brings us more or less to the end of my third voyage in the Scoresby. And in 1938, when we returned to the United Kingdom, the threat of war with Germany had interrupted the Discovery Committee's fieldwork, and the Scoresby was laid up to be taken over later on for naval duties. Now, that left me unemployed. However, in the autumn, my fiancée and I were married, and I got a job with the Aeronautical Inspection Directorate, inspecting wireless equipment and the like. Um,
Where was that situated?
We had a flat in London, and I was working on behalf of the Air Ministry at various firms. Plessy was the one I started at, and then I went on a course, and I was moved from there to other jobs in other parts of the country.
And how did you actually come to join Tavlin?
Well, now, I remained with the Air Ministry job, and I was appointed to Metropolitan Vicars in Manchester about 1940. And there I found myself on a very top secret job, inspecting equipment to equipment for in connection with radiolocation, as it was then called, and beam navigation.
Is that radar?
That's now radar.
Yeah.
And after I'd been 5 years out of the Scoresby and was up at Metropolitan Vicars, I got a summons to visit somebody in London at the Park Lane Hotel. And my group leader at Metropolitan Vicars had no idea what this interview was going to be about. In fact, he told me he actually came to see me on the night before I was due to go down to London and said that after I'd been to this interview, would I telephone the director of the Aeronautical Inspection Directorate and tell him what it was all about. Well, when I got down to London and got to the Park Lane Hotel, I found that it was J.W.S. Marr, and he told me about Tavlin.
Mm-hmm. Had you met Marr before?
I'd never actually met him, but of course he also was one of the scientists connected with Discovery Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And although he hadn't sailed on Scoresby, he'd sailed in the Discovery 2, which was designed for that sort of work,
mm-hmm.
and had done quite a lot of work in her. And furthermore, he had, of course, sailed with Shackleton as Scout Mar when Shackleton chose him as a King Scout to accompany him on his last voyage in the Quest.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early days of the Discovery Committee, Mar had also done a lot of work when the Discovery Committee were using the Scots old ship Discovery for whale marking. Well, of course, Scott's ship wasn't anything like so manoeuvrable as it would need to be for that. And eventually, it was the William Scoresby that was designed and built to take over that work in 1929, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Did Ma tell you why your name had been picked?
Yes. He told me, of course, that it was all a very hush-hush job and it all had to be done in an absolute minimum of time. And he, having been appointed leader of the expedition by the Discovery Committee, who was helping the Colonial Office to mount this expedition, He naturally went for the sort of people who had experience in the Antarctic.
And really, that was discovery investigations, I suppose.
Yes.
Solely. Mm.
Yes. Mm. At that time, when the cabinet learned that the Argentines were putting up metal flags and cylinders about the sovereignty of about claims, I should say, for the Antarctic dependencies. The Navy had never mounted an expedition for anywhere so hard to get at.
Mm.
1,000 miles of sea all around it and ice and so on. And so they turned to the Discovery Committee because of its experience in arranging that sort of thing.
Mm. Mm. Were you responsible for selecting the wireless stores and equipment?
No. Before I was free to leave the emergency job and join the expedition in London, the vital selection of equipment had been made and ordered with the valuable assistance of Admiralty staff and the equipment's pool at HM Signal School, Ledeen.
Mm-hmm.
And so all that, of course, I had nothing whatever to do with, apart from seeing the requisitions.
Did that in fact make your job more difficult, or were you very satisfied?
No, I was very satisfied because I really hadn't had the experience, and particularly I'd been out away from the sea for 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't got the knowledge to know what was best from the point of view of communications in Antarctica at that time.
Mm. Was it the sort of post that you actually could say, no, I don't want to go, or was it more or less you will go?
Well, that's a pointed question and I don't know whether I should answer it.
Okay.
But I did ask Ma if any of the previous operators of the Scoresby had been invited to go, and he said no, that I was his first choice, so far as operators were concerned.
Obviously communications were vital to the expedition. Could you explain your responsibilities as the senior wireless operator?
Yes. My original brief in London was that I should be responsible for assembling the radio equipment at the bases and establish communication with Port Stanley between the bases and with the expedition ships when they were in the vicinity.
Were the other operators responsible to you? Did you have to supervise them? Well, you only had base B in the first year, I suppose.
Well, they were responsible to me in that by the fact that I was the oldest man and had been connected with that sort of work in the Antarctic before, they weren't really junior to me. Or at least I didn't think of them being so.
Mm.
Really, to achieve what we, to achieve my brief, as quoted in London, it was essential to obtain friendly cooperation between myself and the other operator, mm-hmm. or operators as they were later on. But as I expected, this was not difficult to do. And then it was just a matter of arranging things like schedules and procedures with regard to passing information between bases and through Port Stanley to London.
Mm.
And I, while I was at the main base, in the first instance at Port La Croix, while I was there, I was automatically was the main collector of information.
Mm.
But I encouraged the other operators to contact with Stanley when they desired.
Mm. So it didn't have to come through the main base and then be relayed?
No. Mm. Except that later on, as you see, with regard to the first 3 months, we had to be while the whole expedition was still supposed to be secret,
mm-hmm.
we had to be very careful about not cluttering the ether with signals between the different stations and chats about how we were getting on,
mm-hmm.
so that our communications were brief and at fairly regular intervals in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
But later on, when I think it was in May of 1944, that London gave us permission to send three weather reports daily to Stanley.
Mm.
And at that time, we naturally had to collect and relay the weather reports direct to Stanley by one station in order to perform efficiently
mm.
and not to clutter Stanley with calling different stations.
Mm.
But in general, it was a very free between the bases.
Mm. Could you explain what the different forms of communication were? Because I'm never quite sure.
Yes, well, from a radio point of view, in that first year, it was all done by telegraphy.
Mm.
It was all Morse.
That's Morse, yes.
We had no telephony equipment mm. with us. The expedition didn't have any dogs for the first year,
mm.
because had somebody gone to Labrador to collect 20 or 30 expedition dogs, it would be quite obvious where we were going. And because of the secrecy, and also because of the fact that apart from Deception Island, we had to build the bases,
yes.
It wasn't anticipated that we'd be doing any sledging during that first year.
Mm.
So we didn't have, and we also didn't know what the conditions were going to be like from an ice point of view or from the beach point of view. The cargo space was limited on the ship,
mm.
and the
so in fact dogs weren't really appropriate for the first year.
No.
Mm.
We had enough to do without them.
Yeah.
In actual fact, the Mar and three of the others at Hope Bay did do a man-hauling expedition of about nearly a month,
mm.
but they were handicapped in that they, because of the, we had no proper ship or even a strong enough motor launch. They couldn't get to the mainland
mm.
because of the currents in the Girlash Channel and so mm. on. So they did a month's work surveying from the Winkley Island itself, from the island itself.
Could we look at some of the effects of the secrecy that was imposed on Tavlin at first, in terms of its effect on your duties as wireless operator? I think until at least May, everything had to be in cipher.
Yes, and that went on for quite a long time afterwards, actually. But we used what were called one-time pads, and that meant that these pads were rather like a collection of something like about 500 sheets of paper with lots and lots of numbers on them. And we had to, Well, a one-time pad, it involves putting your plain language into code and subtracting the figures, the five-figure ciphers that you get from other figures, and then sending the third lot of figures in your messages in five-figure groups. So it was a sort of thing that you had to really be good at mental arithmetic, but I made it easy by getting Doc back to help me, and he was a tremendous help, and he was a younger brain than I had, and he did all the work really there, a good deal of it.
Because presumably you had to translate what you wanted to send into code and then send that, and when you got something back, you had to translate it out.
To decipher it, yes. Decode it.
And how long would that take in the reach of one day?
Oh well, it depended on the in the early days when we weren't sending many messages. That didn't take very long. But when it came to the middle of the season, when we were sending requisitions for stores, particularly to replace the stores in the existing bases, but even more when we were ordering stores for places like Hope Bay or down at Sydney Island or somewhere like that, these groups would run into as many as 1,000 groups. They were quite large, long messages.
And is a numerical Morse code quicker to send than an alphabetical one?
No, if anything it's slightly longer, I think. Because the figure 1 is a dot and 4 dashes, whereas, but of course, whereas a letter Z even is 2 dashes and 2 dots.
Did you ever have voice to voice radio?
Yes. We asked for that, for portable receivers in particular, for the second year when we had dogs and they were going to send out sledge parties. Now, they sent down a large receiver which weighed something like about 20 pounds, and was not really what we intended. But in addition to that, we asked for portable walkie-talkies. And they sent us down Army Type 3, I think it was, which was worked off batteries, but it weighed about 28 pounds, and it was Morse or telephony.
And how did they work? Were you satisfied with their performance?
Well, there was problems with them, although I wasn't involved in this so much because I was at, by this time, base speed.
Yeah, and they were just used from D.
But they were just used for the either working between the base and the ship while it was unloading at Hope Bay, or on the sledge journeys. But on the first sledge journey, they had very little contact with base on them. This may have been that we weren't used to them. But on the second journey, they had much more contact, and it was Lather, who by that time was at Port La Croix, base A, and he succeeded, together with Andrew Taylor, who was the leader and also on that sledge journey, and he was operating the out in the field, and they did get quite a lot of good success with it.
Oh, good. How was the main base equipment? Did that?
Oh, were you satisfied on with the that? Whole, the main base equipment worked very well. In other words, I couldn't find fault with the selection of the receivers and transmitter which we used for the main bases. And they gave very little trouble.
Would you have had in the right kind of spares if something had gone wrong? Or would it have been
Well, we had the selectors had arranged that it was important. The communication was so important that we had duplicate sets of equipment.
Oh, completely duplicate.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
And that was very useful when we had a fire. I'm now getting off the line of your questioning. I think I better leave that for later on.
That's the fire.
At base B,
yes. Yes, we'll probably come back to that later. Could we, in fact, talk about establishing wireless communications at base A? Well, and B, when you landed there in 1944.
Yes.
So you got the station actually operating in a very short time, didn't you?
Yes, we did. And I think you're going to compare that with the long time we took at establishing communication at Hope Bay.
But there were other problems.
So far as base B and A were concerned, Deception and Port La Croix, our stores had been transferred to the Fitzroy at Port Stanley. And the Fitzroy was a Falkland Islands Company ship which ran between Stanley and Montevideo and the southern ports of South America, and also ran round all the Falkland Islands. She was a ship of about 1,000 tons, but her crew were very experienced in storing equipment aboard the ship, and also in manhandling it under difficult circumstances where they had no port facilities like cranes and so on. Now, both the landings at Deception and at Port La Croix, the ships were in sheltered, almost harbours, at Deception by the very shape of the island, and at Port La Croix because of the mountains round about. Whereas at Hope Bay, it was a very much more exposed site altogether.
And of course the Fitzroy wasn't there with that
and
kind of
the Fitzroy
of
wasn't there either. It was the Eagle. But the other thing too at Deception that made it so quick was that we didn't have to build a hut. They selected one of their old dormitories, which hadn't been used since the whaling finished there, the land whaling finished about 1931, and except for odd times when people were there for a short duration, it had never been used until we got there. So we didn't have to build. So I and Leila, with the help of some of the others, was able to concentrate on getting the wireless cases ashore and all the equipment into one of the rooms, getting an aerial up, and that was very quick. I think, in fact, we did it in something like 36 hours. It would have to be arranged differently later on, but that was all we had to do at that time.
Was it difficult to put things like the aerials up in terms of the weather and that kind of thing?
No, they were telescopic metal masts with cod line stays, and Chippy Ashton was a great help there with regard to if we needed any concrete to put down to hold the pegs, metal pegs, so that they weren't really hard to put up. Later on, they always used stainless steel guys.
So what had you got? I don't really understand.
Oh, we had rather like rope.
Oh, I see.
Rope guys.
So it's not as enduring.
Nothing like so strong. Of course, at Port Lacroix, Chippy Ashton again built a wooden frame with a canvas covering so that I could get my motor generator operating in there under cover before we had the hut finished. But even there, we didn't take longer than about 5 or 6 days to have it going.
Were there any problems, or not really? It all went smoothly.
Oh yes, there were odd problems. Gaskets would need replacing, and sometimes we'd have difficulty starting an engine. But those are all kind of run-of-the-mill things that didn't cause any trouble.
So you sort of had experience of maintaining generators and that kind of thing?
Well, no, I hadn't actually, because of course all my wireless work had been done at sea. So that I would have liked to have had more. And I'm not a driver. I don't drive cars, so that I hadn't had a lot of experience of petrol engines and things. But of course, I did get some very useful advice and help, for instance, from Andrew Taylor about that when I did run into some trouble.
Yes, so there was expertise around. Yeah.
Oh yes, yes. But if I remember right, in my report, at the end of the that part of the expedition, I made a point that all operators ought to be really mechanics as well, to be on, to have it all within your own.
So that if no one was around, you could actually solve the problem. I think you were also responsible for the lighting as well, weren't you?
Well, of course, everybody had more than their own job to do. And one of the jobs that seemed to fall into my sort of sphere was looking after the Vapolux lamps that we use for lighting the building.
Mm-hmm.
And there again, we could have lit the building from the motor generator that we use for charging the batteries and driving the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
But again, on that for that first year, it would be unfair to load your motor generator mm-hmm. with a problem of providing light for the whole of the base.
Mm-hmm.
And also, of course, it would have used a lot more petrol. So that, whereas the Vapolux lamp, they don't all go out if one of them happens to go out, and the Vapolux lamps were very, very suitable, really.
Mm.
So I looked after them for the whole of my time at Port LaCroix, and again when I went to Deception I took that over. I looked after about 20 odd lamps.
Mm. And what did that involve?
Oh, it only involved keeping them clean, keeping them filled with paraffin, and occasionally changing a mantle or something like that. But it was a routine thing. It was quite good.
Yeah.
We all had other jobs to do.
I suppose there were a lot of jobs that individually didn't take much time, but you've got to have someone who's responsible for making sure the job is done.
Yes.
Mm.